I was sitting around minding my own business last Monday, thinking about sermons and responding to the holiday season and seasonal affective disorders, just generally kind of wondering how you take a new take on things. And I realized something. I realized that I have an unnatural fear of chia pets. And I don't want to be a Grinch, but I started wondering about chia pets and where they go the other 11 months, whether they estivate somewhere and then they just come out when they hear the sound of the clapper and the advertisements for the star registry. And how strange our seasons really are, and how strange the kind of social cues are for our great holidays and our holy days, and what in the world these things have to do with holidays and holy days, and why they're only here in December. I mean, a chia pet would seem as hideously inappropriate any month, really. I wonder about these sorts of things, which is probably not healthy on my part, I'll admit. But this is what you have to do. This is what Advent is about. I know this is a Hanukkah sermon, but what Advent is about is preparing yourself for the holidays and trying to find some kind of center in all of the social and cultural chaos that we have in this country. I have no doubt about the fact that we do get anxious when the days get shorter and they turn colder. I see it in the traffic. I see it in people's attitudes. I see it in nervousness. And I don't think it's all about gifts, and I don't think that it is all about money. I think that we are tied to those cycles of nature and that there is something compelling in all of these ways that we fight the darkness, the outer darkness, and the inner darkness. And that's what December is about. It's a brave statement of light in against the encroaching darkness. Well, I'm sitting around thinking about star registries and light and all of the things that we do. And then the phone rings, and the phone calls from the university that asks a very innocent question. Can you teach philosophy? Now, I'm from Southern California, so I know all of the stories are when somebody calls you up and says, can you tap dance? The answer is yes. Can you ride a horse? The answer is yes. Can you tap dance on a horse? The answer is yes. So I said, of course I can teach philosophy. I'm literate. I can find my old books. And when? And they said, tomorrow. I said, so what kind of philosophy? Oh, we don't care. We don't care. But the professor that we had scheduled somehow woke up in Israel and forgot to tell us. I wanted to go to whatever party that professor went to the night before. And so what you have to learn, and this will fit in, believe it or not, this sermon knows where it's going. This will fit into later on in the sermon, which is, in the Middle East, yes is not the end of negotiation. Yes is the beginning of negotiation. So after having said yes, they said, oh, we do have a book. So I go up to the university, I pick up the book, and of course it's very detailed Hellenistic philosophy, and through medieval philosophy, from Philo to Maimonides. I go, okay, I can do that. I studied with the foremost living expert on Philo, and so I emailed my old professor and said, thank you for giving me just enough information to be able to fake a two-hour lecture after 30 years, and he emailed back that he was pretty proud if I could still fake it after 30 years. So I opened up the book, not his, and saw a remarkable statement. And it said that Judaism had looked at Greek philosophy and culture. They stood eye to eye, and Judaism turned away, and that has made all the difference. Now I know I'm in trouble because I completely disagree with the premise of that statement and the premise of that chapter and that philosophical historian. Judaism and Hellenism met in the first, second century before the Common Era, and Judaism said, for the most part, oh, that's pretty neat. Oh, wow, Alexander was pretty great. And Jews started naming their boys Zender, or Alex, Alexander. They started learning Greek. There's some pretty good evidence that, in fact, some obscure Jew named Jesus of Nazareth probably spoke Greek, and much more than he was credited in Scripture with knowing and understanding. And the Jewish community in general was very attracted to Hellenism and to philosophy and to Greek culture, using those names, sending their children to gymnasium instead of to the cheder, and adopting Greek ways, as indeed Jewish people have in the diaspora. They've taken up names and rituals and philosophies from every place where they have passed. It was not a question of turning away and keeping a mythical purity. As Al Shamash, that sun god, tells you, there is no purity. There is no purity of race. There is no purity of religion. Everyone is mestizo. Every religion is gumbo. Everything takes from everything else. After my first lecture, somebody came up to me and said, well, is it possible to take the thread of Judaism out of the fabric of history and just examine it alone? No. We are, as human beings of every background, whatever we call race and ethnicity, we all swim in the same water. That's part of the lesson of ecology. There's only one ocean. There's only one humanity. And our cultures and our symbols and our images all influence one another. Judaism has influenced every place that it has been, and it has been touched by every place that it has been in. When we look back at, when we look right now at Hanukkah celebrations, many of us have been overindulging in potato pancakes. Called latkes. And latkes are, well, the Maccabees never sat down to latkes. And the reason that the Maccabees never sat down to latkes is, well, they never sat down. They were busy fighting all the time and running. But the other reason they never sat down to latkes is they didn't have any potatoes. Potatoes came from the New World. And unless a miraculous high wind blew a bunch of spuds over into the Middle East, they didn't have latkes. In fact, the Aztec word for potato is what we get, is patato. I know it sounds Yiddish, but a little potato is a patato. And tomato is also from the New World, which makes me wonder, you know, anyway, that's a whole other story. You know what how they celebrated originally the festival of this oil? By frying. I mean, oil has always been the big issue in the Middle East. First olive oil and then petrol oil. So this really is, le plus ça change, as they say in Hebrew. And I'm waiting for a look from Eva on that as Hebrew. If you really are looking for a much more authentic, ancient Jewish celebration of Hanukkah, Krispy Kremes. Really, Krispy Kremes. Donuts, beignets, a little bit of jelly is what the Sephardim and the Middle Eastern people eat to celebrate it because they didn't have potatoes, but they wanted to have something that was unhealthily cooked in oil. There's a whole other issue on Jewish cooking. Anyway, the message in all of this is that there is divergent and convergent evolution in every religion and culture. People often get very upset when Hanukkah gets referred to as the Jewish Christmas. But Hanukkah, it was a response to a historic event, but its growth as a celebration has been in response to Christmas. And they have fed off of each other, and you can't take the strains away from each other. We live together. We create foods and habits together. And Hanukkah, as it's celebrated now, is as Jewish and American as chop suey and pizza and bagels and salsa. It is part of the wonderful mix that we offer each other and the diversity that we create and the convergence of those evolutions. It's a wonderful holiday. If you take it at the surface and if you take it way deep down, but if you take it in the middle, I advertise the real story of Hanukkah. The Maccabees were not religious liberals. The Maccabees were fundamentalists. They looked at the Jewish response to Hellenism and were horrified and said, "You people are slip-sliding away. You've lost your religion." The Maccabees were not particularly tolerant, not simply of the Greeks, but of Jews who took Greek names and sent their children to Greek schools and didn't circumcise their males. They thought that this was going to be the extinction of the Jewish people. Now, I point out that Judaism has been conducting and going out of business sale for 3,000 years, and it's true, and still hasn't gone out of business, and the light hasn't gone out, which is the deeper lesson of Hanukkah, that even when the light seems to go out, there is a spark that gets carried forward about where people live with their sense of history and their sense of values. There's another fairly obvious lesson from the Maccabees, and it's not a comfortable lesson for America right now. The Maccabees were guerrillas, and they were fighting an invader who started out kindly, who started out offering culture, and the Jewish community responded. But then when Antiochus said, "Just a second, we've done with this, we're offering you stuff. If you're going to get all the benefits of being Greek, you better take the Greek gods. You better take Greek authority. You better not be yourselves anymore." And so they started to outlaw Jewish practice and Jewish culture. And that is where the breaking point came. It was with the arrogance of power and intolerance that radicals like the Maccabees came about. And it was radicals like the Maccabees, and you can see the parallels in today's Iraq, tragically. You can see the parallels in every Star Wars movie that everybody has ever seen about the big technology fighting a small band of dedicated, gee, I guess they were heroes in Star Wars, but they're fanatics when they're not on your side. You can see it in the Green Mountain Boys of the American Revolution. Now, I'm not preaching politics here. I'm preaching history. And the history is that it is very, very difficult to impose culture and religion on people who don't necessarily reject the culture, but hate the imposition, and will then fight and give their lives in order to defend something that is a deep part of their identity. I am not arguing moral equivalence. I am arguing historic parallels. But the other historic parallel is that the Maccabees won, but it was an ephemera. What, in a sense, did it accomplish? 150 years later, the temple was destroyed. by the Romans, and the diaspora took place. 200 years after America revolted against the English, if we hadn't had a Revolutionary War, what would America look like? I don't know the answer, but it's a thought question. I know, we'd all be speaking English. Maybe pounds or euros. But there's an important question about what we do with our wars, the ephemeral nature of both victory and defeat, and how that plays off against what is in the human heart in every race, time, and culture. And that is a sense of wanting to be safe, wanting to be secure, and wanting at some level to be authentic in our beliefs, to be nourished by the things that nourish us, and to choose how it is that we integrate all of these other cultures and races and influences into our lives. It is the power and the imposition that triggers the conflict, I believe. I believe that Hanukkah and all of these festivals of the light in some ways give us the same message, whether it is Santa Lucia, whether it is a Yule log and Norse fire that is made in the dead of winter to say the fire will not go out, whether it is December 25th and the birthday of Jesus or Saturn or Mithra, which are all on December 25th, and the winter festival of Hanukkah that lights 9 candles against the darkness of the season and the darkness of the heart. And all of these say to us that freedom is precious, that human beings can become down and depressed and have a sense that the light has gone out of our lives, the darkness has closed in. But there is, even when the candles have burned down, a spark that remains. And that the job that we have with each other, the responsibility that we have for each other, is, in the words of E.E. Cummings, to blow upon the embers of the heart and fan that spark back into a flame of light, of truth, of love, and of compassion to all of our fellow beings.